You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. I am Edward Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. With me, as always, is Coyle Neal, assistant professor of political science at Southwestern Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Coyle, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you, Ed?
I'm great. Today we're going to be turning our attention to the Benedict option, an idea which has achieved a lot of attention these days through the work of the person who's most recently coined it, Rod Dreher. The I guess his official title is senior editor at the American Conservative Magazine, but he writes and blogs for a number of different outlets and is a pretty prominent conservative writer and journalist. Coyle, can you get us started and to say something a little bit about what the Benedict option is?
Yeah, so we'll go into more detail on this in a little bit, but the rough idea is what Dreher calls, and this is a quote from the original piece on the Benedict option, communal withdrawal from the mainstream for the sake of sheltering one's faith and family from corrosive modernity and cultivating a more traditional way of life. The rough idea here is that mainstream American culture is a lost cause, or at least close enough for government work. So it's time once again for traditionalists to head to the monasteries where they can preserve Western civilization in seclusion while the rest of the world tears itself apart. So in a sense, the Benedict option is exactly what it sounds like. It's kind of a neo-medievalism, a moving back to the small, self-sufficient local communities where things are held on to while everything else falls apart. And then after the collapse, you know, sort of like the old Irish missionary monks, traditionalists can emerge with their message of renewal and rebirth. There's more to it than that, and it's actually more nuanced than that makes it sound. That makes it sort of sound like they're calling for a new Amish lifestyle. That is not what's going on here, but that's really in a nutshell the core of the argument. Ed, when did you first hear about the Benedict option?
Yeah, so I'm trying to recall. I mean, I can't recall the exact moment. I wasn't familiar with Rod Dreher's writings as a conservative writer and pundit until I think I had sort of heard about his book, and I can't remember if I had heard about his book, The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, first, or I'd heard about the Benedict option idea first. I think the publication of that book and his writing of that article where he sort of, he didn't, as we'll talk about in a second, he didn't coin the term Benedict option. That idea comes from the moral philosopher Alistair MacIntyre. But when Rod Dreher wrote his big Benedict option article in the American Conservative, do you know what year that was off the top of your head?
It was 2013.
Yeah, 13. I think
December of 2013, I believe.
I think his book came out sometime right around there as well. But so the book, Dreher is also the author of Crunchy Cons, which came out earlier. But his book, The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, is a kind of autobiographical memoir of his struggle dealing with his sister Ruthie Lemming's a cancer diagnosis and then eventual death. And when I first heard about that book, I was particularly attentive because Rod Dreher and his sister Ruthie grew up in St. Francisville, Louisiana, which is just outside of Baton Rouge, where my wife and I had taught at LSU for 7 years before we came out west to Westmont. And so it was just sort of striking to me that there was this nationally recognized author who grew up in St. Francisville and was sort of writing and talking about St. Francisville. That book, in large part, is sort of about how Dreher, when he was growing up, felt alienated growing up in this very anti-intellectual, parochial small horizoned South Louisiana town, and always was always looking as he was growing up to run away and to escape and to go on to do greater things as a writer in the big cities. And very precocious, talented youth, and did exactly those things, escaped, wanted to knock the dust off of his sandals and sort of never go back home, which is exactly what happened until his sister starts to get ill and he comes back to spend some time with her in her last days and is just really swept, overwhelmed by the life that his sister has crafted and how integrated into this very tight-knit, rich community of family and friends, and is very moved by both the life that she lives there in supporting her neighbors, and then in turn in her illness really being loved on and supported by her community. That sort of that eventually calls him back home, and so he decides that he's drawn back by this ideal of these small town connections and things like that. So I remember hearing about that and being like, oh, that's really interesting. This guy's from St. Francisville, this tiny town that I happen to know about because I like riding my bike there. In fact, like, I've ridden my bike past the familial Dreher house countless times. There's this map in the front of the book. I was like, I know exactly where that is. I know exactly where that firehouse is.
Did you stop and take a selfie in front of the Dreher household?
That was after we had left at that point. But I'm sort of an avid cyclist. The city of Baton Rouge is maybe one of the most dangerous places in the world to ride a bicycle. But St. Francisville is actually one of the loveliest places in the country to ride a bicycle. There's kind of a famous amateur bike race that goes on there. But the bike routes in St. Francisville go right by his house. But and then the other thing for me is the idea behind the Benedict option is rooted in Alistair MacIntyre's book After Virtue, which, you know, I think is one of the like great works of philosophy written in the latter half of the 20th century. So it was sort of interesting that all of these ideas, this personal familiarity for me, all sort of come together in this idea. How about you, Coyle? When did you first hear about the Benedict option?
I had just moved away from Washington, D.C. To rural Missouri. When the Benedict option article was released, and it sort of made the rounds in some of the circles that I tend to.
Were you an avid reader of Rod Dreher before that article came out?
I had occasionally checked in on the American Conservative website, so it was something I knew about and read from time to time, but I was not familiar with his name specifically. And honestly, even after that, it took a while before, just sort of by attrition, I started to realize that, oh, Rod Dreher is both the overall editor of this website I follow, and he's the guy behind this Benedict option stuff. Mm-hmm. So it took a while before I was really paying more attention to it, in part because when I lived in D.C., so I lived in D.C. for 8 years. Most of the time I was there, I was attending a church called Capitol Hill Baptist. Mm-hmm. When I read this Benedict option, my initial response was, hey, this guy's just talking about a church. Like, what's the big deal here? Why is everyone sort of getting upset about this or excited about this or whatever? Like, of course your local community should be where you're invested. And of course you should be kind of living the life of faith with others, you know, in small groups, in a small community. And then I moved away from Capitol Hill Baptist to a place where churches are okay, but they don't have that mentality of we are both a church and a community. They don't have the idea that the church is your social circle. That was when I started paying attention to the Benedict option a little more and saying, oh, this maybe isn't that common. You know, this isn't something people are actually thinking about and actually trying to live. So, which I guess there's my infomercial for Capitol Hill Baptist. If you are in D.C. on a Sunday and you want to see sort of the Benedict option in practical action, go visit Capitol Hill Baptist. That's just free advertising for them, I guess.
Isn't that's a relatively prominent sort of DC church, isn't it?
For a while, it was the only Southern Baptist church in D.C. That's no longer the case. They've done a few church plants. Uh-huh. But yeah, for a while, it was the literally the only game in town.
Yeah, I've heard of that church, and maybe even I've known people who have gone to that church.
Oh, almost certainly. If you have friends who are Christians traditionalist bent, Baptists and traditionalists, and they live in D.C., they probably go to Capitol Hill Baptist. Mm-hmm. It is by no means the only church. One of the things that was surprising when I moved to D.C., coming from a part of the country that tends to look at the entire East Coast as one paved over godless city, it was surprising how many really good churches there are. D.C. is home to, I mean, I could name off the top of my head just a dozen really, really yeah. good congregations.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the one that I ended up at. And yeah. So yeah, that was how I came to the Benedict option in infomercial. From that, Ed, can you maybe tell us a little bit more about McIntyre? I have not read him. So what's going on in McIntyre that's worth paying attention to, and why does this turn into a political movement a la Rod Dreher?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Dreher's basic idea, the very idea of a Benedict option, is a kind of a popularization of a small suggestion found at the end of Alistair McIntyre's book, After Virtue. It was written in 1981. It's this magisterial analysis of the paradoxes and incoherence of the way that we moderns think about morality and ethics. And I mean, After Virtue is, it's one of the great works of philosophy in the last 50 years. It's a book that has a lot of elements that I myself am sort of critical or skeptical about, but it's just a spectacular analysis of 20th century, of modernity, and especially the way that moderns think about ethics. And McIntyre's book itself is a kind of a book-length treatment of an idea that was inspired by a 1950s paper by the philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, studied under Wittgenstein, was a very faithful Roman Catholic. And Anscombe in the 50s wrote a short paper called Modern Moral Philosophy. And in a nutshell, the argument in that paper, and really the argument that McIntyre's book is trying to advance, is just this idea that the problem for us moderns, the problem for us living in the early 21st century, is that we have inherited a moral vocabulary that is shorn from the foundations under which it made sense. So, for example, much of the way that we think about morality these days is governed by the idea of moral rules or laws, right? So, you know, we think, you shouldn't lie to people, for example. Don't lie to people. And so a lot of the way in which we think about ethics is sort of structured under the category of moral rules that we should follow. But thinking of morality in this way makes sense only when it presumes the idea of a moral lawgiver. An assumption that is increasingly under threat in secular modernity. Or similarly, if we think of virtue terms like courage or temperance, these ideas only make sense under the kind of natural teleology or purpose found in like Aristotle's metaphysics. But the general idea is you strip away these sort of metaphysical underpinnings. You strip away the idea that things are naturally oriented towards certain goals or ends, or you strip away that there is a kind of a divine lawgiver, then you strip away the metaphysical foundations under which these ethical systems make sense. And all you're left with are these concepts that we use all the time, but just lead to all kinds of confusion and incoherence. So outside of these metaphysical frameworks, which are largely abandoned in the modern world, we're left with the vestige of these ethical concepts that just leads to a lot of trouble. And then McIntyre thinks that the end result of all of this is that ethics devolves into a kind of subjectivism. And so you're left with Nietzsche, for whom ethics is all about the individual assertion of a person's own power, right? And that's just the plight of us moderns. And we stumble into all kinds of ethical confusion as a result. And so McIntyre's own solution to this crisis is to try to revive a certain kind of Aristotelian virtue ethic, albeit one with a rather different foundation. I mean, you know, McIntyre himself is kind of an interesting guy because he was most famous in the 70s as being a Marxist sort of moral and political philosopher and an atheist. And then around about the time he was writing After Virtue, he converted to Roman Catholicism. So in these works, and maybe especially in subsequent works, you can see McIntyre increasingly comfortable with theological ideas and concepts. But at the time in which he's writing After Virtue, at least, he had very little desire to try to indulge in either Aristotelian metaphysics or the idea of a divine lawgiver. And so the teleology or goods in McIntyre's account aren't going to come from metaphysics, but he thinks they're fundamentally social in nature and born and sustained by particular communities of people who sustain moral traditions in their lives together, right? And these are going to be the kinds of communities that are increasingly rare in our modern, fragmented, individualistic society. And so all of this is like a very long-winded way of getting to the punchline of the book. And so all of this leads to this passage towards the end of After Virtue, this very famous passage in which McIntyre writes this. If my account of our moral condition is correct, what matters is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and intellectual moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are not waiting for a Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, Saint Benedict. Right? So in other words, McIntyre thinks that as Rome was collapsing into decadence and was getting ready to be overrun by barbarians, ushering in this new period of barbarism and decline in the Dark Ages, he argues that it was Benedict and the Benedictines who established these very specific, very particular communities and traditions that were able to sustain moral life and civility through the Dark Ages until those traditions were able to be recovered in the Renaissance of the medieval period and then going into, I guess, early modernity, right? But he sees this big parallel between the fall of Rome and our current predicament now. We are sort of entering into this new Dark Ages. And just as the salvation of the best of the Western intellectual and cultural traditions were sustained by Benedictines through these Dark Ages, so too does he think that we need a kind of a new Benedict, or we need to go back to that that Benedictine model of pursuing small, tight-knit, particular communities that have very, very rich social practices and traditions that are able to harbor and sustain these visions of moral life through these new Dark Ages. So that's sort of the deep background behind Dreher's project. Coyle, do you want to talk a little bit more about how Dreher himself develops this idea that he gets from McIntyre into this own specific vision?
Just a very little bit, because Dreher himself has I'm not sure how best to describe it. He has sort of stalled in his development of this. So there are, you know, dozens of blog posts, dozens of articles from the American Conservative over the past 3 years about the Benedict option. And hundreds of writings from other places. So people have been, you know, left and right coming out with the Dominican option and the Francis option and the Jeremiah option and the Daniel option. I mean, we could just go through the list of all the different things that have come up. Mm-hmm. Dreher himself is writing a book, and I think that's where we're going to get sort of the final formulation of it when he gets around to getting it published. One of the problems that I suspect he has run into is because he is calling for people to return to the local and the communal, By definition, it is hard to write a wide-ranging book on how you be local and communal. So I suspect that's part of the cause for the delay, although I don't know. I've not talked to him about this individually.
Do you know him?
No. He presented a paper, or he was the keynote speaker at a conference that I was supposed to attend and then didn't. But I have a number of connections with him, mm-hmm. Mutual friends, that sort of thing. I think I've met him a couple of times, although it was back before I knew who he was. I think he and I have been at the same conferences. So all of that to say that there are some things that we can say about the Benedict option, especially in terms of its appeal. And I think that there are a couple of levels at work. So a couple of things going on with Benedict. The first is a very surface level appeal, right? The idea that these groups of people who are sort of loosely associated with each other, traditionalists, agrarians, and Christians, specifically evangelical and Roman mm-hmm. Catholic Christians. And I suppose we should throw in Eastern Orthodox because Dreyer himself is Eastern Orthodox.
Yeah, he converted to Catholicism. I think when he was growing up, he grew up Methodist, but wasn't particularly religious. And then maybe sometime in college or post-college became Roman Catholic and then became Orthodox sort of in the wake of the scandals in the Catholic Church.
Right. So, you know, he's moving in the right direction. You know, he'll get there
Southern
eventually.
Baptist
that's my hope. We can keep praying for that. I mean, he does live in Louisiana, so, you know, he can't be that far off from it. So we have these three groups of people, traditionalists, agrarians, and various shades of Christians who this is appealing to, in part because they watch, you know, what's going on in the country, what's happening with the culture, what's happening politically, and say, you know, it is getting harder and harder to see how we're going to dig ourselves out of it. So we look at the culture and say, you know, it would be one thing if mainstream American culture were, you know, embracing pagan virtues instead of traditional Christian ones. You know, if our culture had become obsessed with courage or wisdom or temperance or something like that, that would be manageable. Because our culture appears to be increasingly obsessed with vice, The call to retreat, the call to a dignified retreat, I think is more and more appealing. The call to reject the mainstream culture, to turn to the small, the personal, and the local, that has a lot of force among those of us who are increasingly sort of dismayed by what's going on a large scale. That's a very surface level appeal. I think it's where a lot of people sort of jump on board with the Benedict option, but that's not really all that's going on.
Yeah. One of the major criticisms of it is just that it is retreatist, and those criticisms become all the more pointed when they are made by Christians who feel like it's an abandonment of right. our call to engage the world. But then Dreyer is sort of quick to say, no, it isn't retreatist.
So it is and it isn't, right? I mean, it is... And I hate this word because it is so loaded, but it is what we might call an existentialist retreat, right? So Dreyer is not saying don't vote in the election this November, right? He is not saying stop reading the New York Times and only read your local newspaper. He is saying sort of emotionally, you know, mentally, existentially, for lack of a better phrase, unhitch yourself from those big national movements and totally invest yourself mm-hmm. in the local. So when I'm sort of thinking through my list of priorities for my own life, and I'm thinking, all right, what matters most to me in terms of politics? Number one on that list should be Bolivar, Missouri, because that's where I live. Not who gets the Republican nomination, who gets the Democrat nomination. Not that those things don't matter, mm-hmm. just that they shouldn't be number one. That's sort of the heart of the Benedict option is not a not exactly a literal withdrawal, not that we just say, well, I don't care. It's I don't care about that as much as who the mayor of my small town is. And that, I think, leads into the more substantive part of the Benedict option. And this this uh, I don't think has been worked out systematically yet. But so, you know, if you've been following this Benedict Option stuff more closely than I have, you know, please send us an email and tell me I'm crazy. But from what I can tell, the main kind of philosophical appeal of the Benedict Option is that it taps into an instinct that many on the traditional side of things have, that what makes government work, that what makes politics at any level work, is what goes on at the local level and non-political stuff. So just the great example of this, think for a second of the Puritan colonies that were founded in New England, up and down the Eastern Seaboard. Those colonies were not originally inherently political. There were certainly political things that they did, but their determined goal was to have a faithful and holy church. So they set up institutions that were dedicated to generating the sorts of virtues that would create a pure church. You know, hence the name Puritans. What happened along the way, you know, over the course of a century, as those institutions sort of pursued that goal, is almost as a an after effect, as a side effect. You get a generation of people who are just phenomenally brilliant politically. You get this generation of intellectuals and leaders and generals and all of these other things who are capable of great political actions and great political thought. In some sense, really the only generation of Americans that we've had that have done that. The idea is this virtue that's necessary for the creation of these figures is something that happened unintentionally at the local level. It's something that happened small and then was exported to the large level. There's a great quote in T.S. Eliot. See if I can pull it up here. So T.S. Eliot says, "Culture is the one thing we cannot deliberately aim at. It is the product of a variety of more or less harmonious activities, each pursued for its own sake. The artist must concentrate upon his canvas, the poet upon his typewriter, the civil servant upon the just settlement of particular problems as they present themselves upon his desk, each according to the situation in which he finds himself. Even if these conditions with which I am concerned seem to the reader to represent desirable social aims, he must not leap to the conclusion that these aims can be filled solely by deliberate organization." So the idea is whenever we try deliberately to generate those ends at the national level, we fail because that's just not how things work. So the Benedict Option is a call to reinvest in these local institutions that are mostly not political, but that generate the sorts of virtue and leadership that we need to survive and live well. So if vibrant liberal democracy is the goal, then we can't start at the top and sort of define that downward. We have to start at the bottom and focus on things other than democracy, and build upward from there, really without trying to build at all. So I think that's what's going on there. You know, the Benedict Option is implicitly arguing that virtue is something you capture on a small level and pass on to a higher one by the free uh-huh. operations of local actors. Individuals, small organizations are the ones who do the heavy lifting if we want our society to be well-grounded.
So can I ask a question? You know, I've read The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, and I've read Dreyer's core Benedict Option articles and some of his clarifications and some of his responses to criticisms and things like that. But you've read considerably more of that stuff than I have. So I'm a little bit surprised that bit that you were just talking about, in which it sort of sets up like this return. It sets up the redemption of, say, national American cultural and political life as a goal. My question is that your gloss on Dreyer, or is Dreyer explicit about that?
No. That's sort of my interpretation of why this has taken off as much as it has. Again, you can't set that as the goal. By definition, you can't set that as the goal. You cannot say, I'm going to go to my Rotary Club meeting uh-huh. because I want America to be great again. You can't do that. You have to say, I'm going to go to my Rotary Club meeting because there's something very important going on there. The side effect of that is, if everybody does that, if these local institutions get, you know, start to develop and grow, in the long
we'll
run,
we'll be inculcating the kind of people who are necessary for flourishing national public political culture.
Right. But the second that you think I am doing this for the national good, that's the second you kill it. That's when you put it to death, because now you no longer actually care about your local community. Now you're doing something for, you know, people you've never met and that you will never see and that have no direct bearing on your day-to-day life. I also think this probably won't work, but that's, maybe we should save that question for last.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe that's right as a kind of an analysis of why it's taken off. That seems to be a little bit distinct from the stated aspirations of the Benedict. I mean, so I would have said this, like, and this is connected to one of the most prominent criticisms. I would have said that the reason why the idea has taken off amongst politically conservative Christians, or maybe just politically American conservatives in general, is just this realization that we've lost the culture war. If we're going to survive in any way, shape, or form, we just need to escape and retreat.
Absolutely. Right. So we've lost on the national level. Time to reinvest locally. In some ways, it's sort of what the Republican Party did, 40 years ago, 50 years ago at this point, when there was the reinvestment in state and local politics, the doubling down on what goes on, you know, in the governor's races and the state legislatures around the country. It's in some ways kind of a cultural version of that, the idea that we're not going to be able to win this national stuff because there just aren't that many of us. But if we focus on the places where we can win, well, that's important. So I think there's certainly that appeal too. Obviously, the core of Dreher's argument, so the explicitly stated argument is you need to be doing this because this is the stuff that matters most anyway. You need to be investing locally, not just because that's where you're going to win, but because that's, you know, that is what's important.
Yep.
To put it in the Christian terms, love your neighbor means literally love your neighbor, the person who lives next door to you.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think that, you know, running through the idea is just this idea, and you can see this in the little way of Ruthie Lemming and the things that draw Dreher back to this small Louisiana town of his birth and where his family still is just that in that small communal life, you just get certain kinds of goods that you don't get in the individualistic modern world, right? You're recovering certain kinds of social relations and certain kinds of social relations and meaningful interactions. And then other kinds of goods get preserved in these social traditions, these very specific social traditions and practices, which maintain certain kinds of values. And so like that just in and of itself is a kind of a good. But then, you know, there's also this idea that this is the only way we're going to survive. If we're going to preserve these values, we're going to have to go, is a little bit of an exaggeration, I guess, but sort of go underground, concentrate on our local communities, preserve these ideas and traditions until such a time in which they can be revived again, just as they were with Benedict.
So the idea is that the good, the true, and the beautiful will only be preserved if we focus on where that actually exists anyway. Which sort of, I think, raises an interesting criticism. So we ought to, you know, pursue this good life in our local town. It's one thing, I've never been to St. Francisville, but, you know, based on your description of it, it's a very nice little town. I live in a little town that's phenomenal. You live in Santa Barbara, right? Which by all accounts is also a very nice little town, although I don't know how little it is. What if you live somewhere that is just awful? You know, what if, so there are towns that I have lived in the past, and I will leave that vague enough that I don't offend anyone, that are just
awful,
terrible,
towns.
Terrible places. And frankly, what those towns need most is a good fire. I mean, it just, you know, and that is not an exaggeration. So in a sense, Dreher can say this because he is living in a place that is sort of inherently lovely. you know, what if you're living somewhere that's inherently ugly? What if you're living in a place where it's worse than it is on the national level? Anyway, that is a criticism that again,
is compelling about the Ruthie Lemming book is that it's not just this romantic portrait of nostalgic portrait of like some kind of fantasy of small town life in the 50s. Like, and Dreher is like moving back is hard. And Dreher is ambivalent about a lot of things. And he still thinks that people can be really small-minded and narrow. And they are nursing these old grievances. And there's a point at which he moves back. They rent this house right on, like, the main street. And it is, like, the environment of St. Francisville, like, is lovely. At least parts of it. But, like, it's like...
Right.
He worries that they've made a mistake. That there are these sort of old petty grievances that still remain. And so it's not like this just rich, romantic, nostalgic portrait of like, it's hard.
Right. So it's not to say that everything about the town is good. Again, the problem, again, one of my problems is, you know, if you live in a town where little is good, where you don't even have the upsides, right? All you have is the rough parts of small town, rural, Or even if you're in a city, right? I mean, the Benedict option is not exclusively for small towns. It is also for urban centers and so on. I thought it was just to switch gears a little bit. I thought it was interesting that you had talked about we survive only by, you know, retreating, by withdrawing. Would you say that this is and I'm using this word on purpose. Would you say that this is sort of a survivalist mentality?
Yeah, so I mean, that gets at something that I wanted to chase to. I have another question for you, but I'll hold on to that for a second. I mean. To me, the most prominent criticism of it is that this is just sour grapes conservatives who are taking their toys and going home, right? And then a lot of people, maybe because they're not conservatives, are sort of like, well, I just want to have nothing to do with that. But then especially, I mean, Dreher is a person of religious conviction. And he's painting this not just as a strategy for conservatives, but sort of like part of a vision of what the Christian life is supposed to be like, right? And then a lot of the sharpest criticisms have been from Christians who see this as being retreatist, as just being sort of sour grapes we lost. We're just going to go home now. And then Dreher is really adamant that it's not that, right? Which is sort of why... your portrayal of him is kind of interesting to me because like in your portrayal of him, it makes it seem that like it's a little bit more the sour grapes retreatism.
Yeah. I think it can be that. And again, I think that is part of the appeal of it to people is the, you know, not so much sour grapes, but you know, here is a way we can not just lose everything. You know, as we have talked about in previous episodes, here is a way that men can still use the men's room and women can still use the women's room. There is, as you were talking about, that attempt to preserve some of the traditions and virtues that are carried along in communal life. But there is the positive side of it as well, and this is where I agree with Dreher in that this is what ought to be going on in the church anyway. Not so much politically, although there is the political element of it, but. Yes, absolutely. As a Christian, my primary social, communal, political, whatever words you want to use, life ought to be invested in my local church, right? The people that I see every Sunday are literally the most important people in the world to me outside of my wife and children. That is how things should be. That is where my primary investment should be. We are the people who have covenanted together to pursue holiness. Those are the people I'm going to be seeing for all of eternity. In that sense, Dreher is absolutely right. Some of my pushback comes when you start turning that political, when you start sort of exporting that from the church into the community. Even then, I think that what he's saying is mostly true. I think that the stuff that your local government does is vastly more important than anything that Washington, D.C. does for many reasons, both practical and philosophical. But again, that's also where I kind of say, well, I think I agree, but I also think you're going to have trouble selling this. I think there's going to be some resistance to that. Did that answer your question? So and there's the positive side too. It's not just the we've lost, so we're going home. Good luck fixing things without conservatives. Although again, there are moments when I think that, but there is the positive side of this is what we ought to have been doing.
Yeah, and so the other big criticism that you see is people writing and saying, I don't know what he's talking about. He's just describing what the church is. Like, this has always been what the church should be. This has always been what Christian communities should look like. And then he typically says, yeah, that's exactly right. But it's just we've churches typically don't look like that anymore. And Christians are doing a really bad job of inculcating the really rich and full vision of what it is to be a follower of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He frequently references the work of the sociologist Christian Smith and appeals to this idea. Smith did the study of young evangelicals, and he sort of describes their view of what it is to be a Christian as moralistic therapeutic deism. That it's just a kind of a psychologized, feel-good, help other people, and it isn't really rooted in any of the specific thick particularities of what it is to really be a Christian, right? So part of it is, like, we just done this really bad job of forming our children into the specific visions of what it is to be a Christian.
And just a great measure of that, and this would need to be worked out in detail, but a great sort of barometer for that in any given church. So we talked a few episodes about you asked me about social justice and how Glenn Beck had said, you know, if your church website says, you know, something about social justice, you should leave. I don't agree with that, but I think something that can be a good barometer, you know, is your local church just teaching moralistic therapeutic deism, or do they actually believe something? Do they actually have a community? Is what is the role of church discipline? If you are a member of a church that has never disciplined anyone, you're probably in a church that is, you know, teaching moralistic therapeutic deism. Just by definition, like assuming that the church is, you know, more than 5 or 10 people, and assuming your church has been around for a while, obviously this doesn't apply to church plants or those sorts of things. But if you're in a church that has a longish history and has many members, the odds that you have a member who needs to be disciplined are pretty high. And if they haven't done that, well, again, there's sort of your quick and dirty measure. That is not to celebrate church discipline as a good thing. Obviously, it's a very negative thing. It's something that we always have to regret when it needs to happen. But again, it does need to happen. How do we get on church discipline?
That strikes me as being a little bit harsh. I have to say now I'm intrigued. Like, what does church discipline look like in your experiences?
It depends on the issue. I'd look at the Matthew 18 passage and say that there's an entire spectrum of discipline that starts with, as a member, you know, someone sees me committing a sin, comes to me and says, "Hey, Coyle, I noticed that you sort of delight in running red lights and you celebrate that. Maybe you ought not be doing that as a Christian. You know, at least scrape the Jesus bumper sticker off your car," which I don't think we have a Jesus bumper sticker on our car. But, you know, if we did, you are making Christ look bad when you do that. So that first stage would be the individual member coming to me. A second stage, if I'm like, no, running red lights is a good thing and I love doing it and I don't care what the state government says. The second stage would be a couple of members of the church coming to me and saying, "Hey, we've noticed this. We think this is a sin. Maybe it's not explicitly a sin in the Bible that running red lights, but you are not rendering unto Caesar. You're violating Romans 13 in principle and in practice." And then if I'm still unrepentant, then maybe the elders of the church get involved, and the elders start asking me questions about it and investigating. And turns out that sure enough, I am very unrepentant about that, and I'm just going to keep doing it. And I don't care what they say. And then sort of the final option is the church says, "Yeah, when we admitted you to this church, we did it because we thought you were a Christian. Now you have given evidence by your words and by your life that you are not. So we have to remove you from our roles sort of regretfully until such time as you repent and once again, you know, and give evidence that you are a believer." Obviously,
does remove you from our roles mean don't come back?
No.
Or does it mean you just can't vote?
No. It means that I don't get to participate in the government of the church.
Yeah.
And it means that I don't get to take communion. So I am not a part, not allowed. Now, we pass the communion basket out, as many churches do. So technically, someone who has been excommunicated, if they show up at church, they could take food out of the basket. They have been told not to, right? They've been told not to, and if they do, that's sort of on them. Obviously, running red lights is a silly example. It gets much more serious when you talk about something like, the guy who moves in with his girlfriend and is like, yeah, I'm not going to marry her. But we are doing all of this illicit stuff, and it's fun, and I like it, and you Christians are just crazy, right? There are certainly sins where discipline is called for, and again, there is that entire process. How did we get on that? Oh, right. So a picture of whether or not a church is living well in community. I think communion is another good example of it. There are churches that just never take communion. That's something that, especially in my own Baptist world, churches can be very guilty of. It's easy to go from churches that only take communion once a year to just not ever doing it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an explicit command in Scripture. Are you doing it or are you not doing it?
Churches that like never do it?
There are churches that never do it. Churches that otherwise are very well intentioned, maybe even are teaching true things, but just never do that.
On principle, or just sort of like
just it slips through the cracks. Uh-huh. I don't know that I've ever met someone who's a member of a church who's like, no, we don't do communion because we think it's bad.
Because it's too Romish.
Yeah, I have met people who are like, yeah, we keep meaning to do it and we didn't. Well, uh-huh. there comes a point where you're like, well, how long have you been meaning to do it? And they're like, well, 10 years. I'm like, well, come on, man.
There are churches that haven't done.
There are actually, I no names. I am thinking of an East Coast church, half the country there, where they had been on the once a year schedule. Their old pastor retired. They got a new pastor who sort of always intended to do it, but just never got around to it.
Uh huh.
Anyway, it doesn't have to be either of those things. But again, the question is the congregation invested in each other's lives? Is the church leadership leading the congregation well? Is the congregation governing the church well? I mean, we could go through all of these different things. The point is that the Benedict option is a social version of what churches, I think, scripturally ought to be doing and usually are not.
Yeah,
I don't know that we'll get any pushback on that. I mean, do you think churches are actually know they're great and they're all doing what they should be? I mean, I think it'd be really hard to look at modern American evangelical culture and say, yeah, these churches are all great and right where they should be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think anything disputes that. Can I ask you a question? So the dialogue on all of this stuff.
Sure.
It certainly generated like a cottage industry of people chiming in. And there's just something about the idea that has caught people's imaginations, either inspired them or like they're critical of it. Are the people participating in that dialogue, are they conservatives, or are they conservative Christians, or are they Christians?
Yes, and yes. I'm trying to think if I've read any responses from atheists. I don't know that I have. That doesn't mean they don't exist. I have read a lot of them. I presented a paper on this a couple of months back, where I basically had to read through all of this stuff, which, let me tell you, someone needs to come up with a good way to cite blog posts academically. Turabian is falling down on the job when it comes to that. Anyway,
there's an MLA convention, isn't there?
There is, but it's very loose. Uh-huh. And it's MLA, and MLA is terrible. Yeah. So,
well, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, Chicago is
the footnote guy.
Yeah, me too.
And if the footnotes are in the back, if you have to turn to get the footnotes, that drives me crazy.
Oh, see, I guess I'm an EndNote guy. I hate it when they clutter up the text on the page I'm reading.
Like, oh, really?
Yep. I read the text and then I read the footnotes. So when they're on the page, I cannot resist that ability to look down and see the note. And that slows me down so much.
I hate having to flip. That drives me crazy. Anyway.
So I do not know of any atheist responses. The vast majority have certainly been from conservative Christians, especially of the Roman Catholic variety, but also a handful of Protestants have chimed in as well.
Yeah. Yeah. My idea there wasn't so much like whether conservative atheists were chiming in, but just the extent to which these discussions have been theological in nature is too strong, but sort of informed by theological concern.
Yeah. So some of them, and some of the things you were bringing up, the idea that, this is removing the witness from the world, questions about the role of either Christians individually or the church corporately in social life. Those things have all come up, and that's where you get into the weeds of theology, of course.
Yeah.
And that's because the Bible is often so vague about that. I think those discussions tend not always to be as valuable as they maybe could be. Mm-hmm. But I think that is more just because the Bible isn't always dealing with that.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. So for me, I mean, my intellectual biography has been formed by McIntyre's After Virtue book, which again, I'm critical of certain aspects. I mean, I'm critical of the main thesis in a lot of ways, but I just think it's a hugely interesting book. You know, another formative book behind the idea for Dreher is Stanley Hauerwas and Willimon's Resident Aliens.
Sure.
Which also was a hugely formative book for me in grad school, maybe it was when I first read it. And I mean, in a lot of ways, he's taking... And even Hauerwas and Willimon, they're formed by... Hauerwas is deeply formed by McIntyre's work, and it's a more theologized version of that. And so for me personally, like just in my own intellectual biography, those works were hugely formative. And so I find this basic vision of very intentional, tight-knit, particular Christian communities doing what Christians are supposed to be doing to each other and thus testifying to the love of God for the world as just being part and parcel of what is to be a Christian. And so, like, all of that stuff, I find, you know, deeply, deeply interesting.
Well, right. I mean, obviously, I don't think either of us disagree with that part.
Yeah.
What do you think about his exporting that from the church to the town?
Sorry, to the ten?
To the town, to the city.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. So I mean, that's really the core of the Benedict option, right? It's not that uh-huh. this stuff should be going on in the church. Of course it should be. It's mm-hmm. this should also be going on in Santa Barbara, in Bolivar, in, you know, St. Francisville, in all of the other towns. That I think is the contentious point, and that's the that's really what the Benedict option is. Not just that Christians ought to be doing this anyway, but that this should also have a social, a political, a communal side beyond the church.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure that I understand your question. The Benedict option is specifically a call for Christians, really, but for other like-minded fellow travelers,
right,
to try to preserve a specific set of values and way of life.
Yep.
And Christians and these fellow travelers were living in these small communities, but it's certainly a part, and I didn't mean to imply that these communities were supposed to be sort of very insular.
Sure.
And he is adamant about it not being insular, and it is a way of sort of living that out in the world, albeit in our small communities. That's what you're getting at, right?
Well, right. So it's not just that Christians ought to be doing this in churches. It's that we ought to be reinvesting in the community as a whole, right? So in a sense, it's sort of a return to anti-federalism, right? The idea that it's a local government, a local community, local institutions, mm-hmm. Again, across the board. So, yeah, again, what do you think about that? Like,
yeah, so, I mean, and I don't disagree with that either. I mean, I think that's fine, though this starts to get to the aspect of the account that I'm sort of skeptical about. So, again, I think I'm the kind of person that says, oh, he's just describing what the church should be doing. And whenever anybody makes that retreatist, insular criticism, he's like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And he's very specific about that.
Yes, but again, we're moving now beyond the church to the community. Yeah. So
yeah, and then I would say, yeah, and that's a part of the Christian vision, that it's not meant to be insular. I guess, so like the worry and the criticism that I have about it is that like while all the official, like the official pronouncement of what the Ben Op is... I think all of those are right. And, you know, that bit about going, I mean, it's not meant to be insular. It's meant to sort of be.
I'm sorry. I'm asking the question wrong. So part of the Benedict option is not just that the church should not be insular. That's a criticism of it. And like you said, that's one that Dreher responds to. But part of the Benedict option is that we as citizens, as individuals in a community, should also be primarily invested in our local town. So again, to use the example from earlier, if we're buying into the Benedict option, you should be more invested in who wins the mayor's race in Santa Barbara than you are in who wins the presidency of the United States this November. That's the part I'm asking you. What do you think about that? So your primary citizenship is your local community. That's where you need to be most focused, apart from your church membership. Right? Not that the church should not be invested in the local community, but that, again, this the social side, the political side of the Benedict option is that local government thing, those local institutions, they matter most.
And so maybe I would say this. I'm a little neutral on that idea. I suppose in its strongest form, I'm critical of that idea, and that gets a little bit... And so maybe that's a way of getting into my criticism of the whole thing. So while I think all the official pronouncements of it are right, there is just this way in which, to me, it's certainly, at least historically, motivated by a kind of sour grapes, look, we've lost, let's just retreat and go home and preserve our way of life.
Right.
I think it's certainly motivated. And in the official pronouncements, he's clear to say, that's not just all it is. But I feel like it certainly is motivated by that. And even when you look at that official description that you quoted earlier, right? So he says, quote, "communal withdrawal from the mainstream for the sake of sheltering one's faith and family from corrosive modernity and cultivating a more traditional way of life."
Right.
In that official pronouncement, which is the first, this is what it is. And then he goes on to qualify it. But in that first official pronouncement, that is a very sort of escape from the world, protect ourselves, protect our way of life kind of a mindset.
Right.
And as he qualifies that idea, he's sort of very quick to say, but it's not insular. But I sort of worry that, in the way in which the idea is taking shape amongst conservative Christians, it is sort of motivated by, this withdrawal, this concern for our own purity, this worry about the corrosive effects of modernity. And I'm worried about those things. But I sort of worry that the ethos of the whole project is a little bit sour grapes, let's protect ourselves. And that, I think, is antithetical to the gospel. I mean, we certainly need to be concerned about fidelity to the gospel and what the gospel calls us to. But then I would say that, we were talking about this earlier, off the air, but the gospel calls us to engage the world. And I think it calls us to engage the world widely, which is, and so now to get back to your original question, I think that that restrictor plate on local, not that national politics doesn't matter, but local politics has to matter more.
Right.
I don't know if that kind of restriction makes sense in the way that I understand what God's call to be agents of his redemptive work.
So you're encouraging sort of a mass surrender to modernity.
No, so that was a sarcastic question.
That was a sarcastic question. Yeah. I mean, obviously there is a gospel, there is a worldwide component to the gospel. I mean, the Great Commission tells us to go into all the world. Mm-hmm. So I would agree with you as far as that goes. Yeah. Again, though, I like the appeal of local, small, focus on the political appeal of local, small, and so on. My criticism of the Benedict option is I just don't think it'll work. I don't think Americans have it in them to even mentally reject the national in favor of the local. I do not think that is something we are temperamentally capable of. So whatever the merits of it, I don't see it being practical.
Yeah, and so, I mean, in a certain kind of way, I don't know that he would disagree with you. Like, he's not like, everybody's going to do this.
Right.
He's like, some people are doing this,
yep,
and are going to do this. They're not going to be very many of them.
We just need enough people to, you know, survive the utter collapse of everything.
Like, yes.
Just that minimal number. And again, that's where we're back to the Benedict option. You don't need all of England to be a monastery. You just need a few islands off the coast of Scotland.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And same sort of thing now. We don't need everyone to be, you know, rushing to embrace the local. We just need enough people to do so. Mm-hmm. I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not there will even be enough. So I guess I am more of a pessimist than Rod Dreher. Not that I don't think this is a good idea. The political side of it, I think, is a good idea. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That that call to nationalism is far too strong for the American people, I think.
I mean, again, I don't know that he would disagree with that. It's not like he's like, we're going to do this and it's going to work. It's a little bit more, I mean, there's something sort of tragic about it. It's like, look, we got to do this. What other option do we have? And there's no real reason to think that it will succeed, but what other option do we have? And this is the only path towards success.
Right. And I'm not the person to talk much about this. There's a book that was written in the 1920s, I think, called The Decline of the West, by a guy named Oswald Spengler, where he makes a number of arguments. I don't know if he was a believer or not. He was a Nietzschean in his approach to history. But his argument is that if you find yourself in a declining situation, as he tended to see Europe at the time, his argument was that it's your responsibility then not to try to stop the decline and not to try to reverse it, but to try to live well in it, to try mm-hmm. to sort of ride it down, ride out the decline in a way that is appropriate and faithful. And so in that sense, it may be that what we need is not, you know, a Benedict. What we need is an Augustine. We need someone who can say, look, you know, things are falling apart, and here's how you live in a world where things are falling apart. Mm-hmm. Here's how you stay faithful as, you know, everything collapses around you.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
and how is that different than the Benedictine option? Is it less insular?
It's less insular, but it's also the point isn't we're going to save something. The point is we're just going to, you know, we're going to understand that things are falling apart and do the best we can, whether we save anything or not. In a sense, it is much, much less cheerful, but I think still just as faithful. Again, that's not to say if the Benedict option works, it works. That'll be a fine thing. I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you've obviously read a lot more of all of this literature than I have, but I mean, I don't know that there is this air of sort of optimistic American, and we're going to win in the end.
Right, right.
The whole thing is sort of covered in this veil of like tragedy and pessimism. And what other option do we have? And maybe it'll work. If it works, this is the only way it's going to work. Probably not going to work.
Right.
But
and I'm saying, but again, that's too optimistic.
It's not going to work.
It's not going to work.
What's the point? Yeah, and then I would say to me, again, like this vision of tight-knit communal life, I think that's just what it is to be a Christian. But the thing that makes me nervous is that there's a little bit of this, too much of a concern for our own purity, and too much of this kind of insularity as part of the ethos of it, that concerns me. And you know, you made that crack about modernity. Like, I was trained up in grad school. We were at UVA. I was in the philosophy department, but Felicia was a student of, and we were both fellows at James Hunter's Institute, you know, the sociologist James Hunter. And, like, you know, there is no more pessimistic critic of modernity than James Hunter. And so there's a way in which we sort of imbibed in a fundamental way, like, this worries about and pessimism about modernity. But so with all of that said, you know, my wife studies technology and the social effects of technology. She's extremely exercised about all of that stuff. But I think there's still a way in which, you know, so like the Essenes, from whom we got the Dead Sea Scroll, you know, they were a community of Jews who thought the world was going to hell in a handbasket, and so escaped to the desert and lived in these caves.
And how did things work out for them?
Well, I mean, you know, they bequeathed to us the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was quite a big thing.
They did. They also got wiped out. When I mean, they, yeah, they well, weren't that's wrong. Exactly. You know,
yeah.
Rome came in and obliterated them.
Yeah. And to me, the Benedict option sort of feels a little bit like that. Again, if not official in the official pronouncement, I certainly think it's the case that when you read Dreher's other kinds of writings and even certain bits in the official Benedict option stuff, I think there is kind of this ethos of concern for our own purity that I think... Now, look, I'm concerned about our own purity. I'm exercised by and worried about modernity. But I think there's a way in which it calls us out into the world beyond sort of the ethos that I sometimes get out of Dreher's writing. And I also think that sort of despite all of that, there's this cultural warrior mindset that runs through Rod Dreher that I think is just antithetical to the gospel. But that's maybe a story for another day.
Right. Well, anything else on the Benedict option? I guess we've covered whether or not we think it'll work, whether we think it's a good idea. What other things to read?
Yeah, so, I mean, as you well noted, it's easy to start on the Benedict option thread and then get quickly sucked into the rabbit hole.
Oh, sure.
There's this huge cottage industry now of Ben Ops people who are refining, and in some ways it's really exciting as the idea gets refined and developed, and there are people who are hugely critical of parts of it but want to preserve other parts of it, and like the idea is getting developed and enriched. But certainly if you just Google Benedict option, you will quickly fall into that whole literature. If you're really hardcore, you could go back and read Alistair MacIntyre's book After Virtue. If you are sort of looking at this full-scale philosophical analysis and critique of modernity and its ideology, and especially the kinds of paradoxes and confusions that we fall into in our moral life, I recommend MacIntyre's book. And then even in MacIntyre's book, like, that idea evolves in fundamental ways. That's pretty heavy sledding, but, you know, again, one of the great works, I think, written in philosophy in the last 50 years. We mentioned Christian Smith's work. I think that, you know, his work on young evangelicals is really, really interesting. He's super stimulating. We mentioned Harawas and Willimon's Resident Aliens. That's like I think another great classic of Christian popular theology. How about you, Cole? Do you have other suggestions for recommended reading?
Yeah, again, until this Benedict option book comes out.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of the thing everyone is still waiting on. I would say if you are interested in the idea of the Benedict option and like genuinely interested in it and not just sort of surface level interested in it, it's incumbent on you to read up on the Middle Ages. Because again, that's really what we're talking about is sort of a neo-medievalism, a neo-feudalism, going back to the local as a loose association of other local things, kind of loosely tied together by culture. So I'll throw up on the website a couple of good histories of the early Middle Ages. Ganshoff's book on feudalism is the classic. Augustine's City of God, of course, I've already mentioned. And a novel that I think is worth taking a look at, Walter Miller's Canticle for Leibowitz, is mm-hmm. basically exactly what Dreher is suggesting, albeit in a much more extreme form. It's one of the great works of science fiction. I think one of the only works of science fiction written by a Christian. Miller's a Roman Catholic writer who had a very, very dim view of the world. The basic plot is... nuclear war, written in the 60s, so nuclear war wipes out civilization. The Catholic Church in monasteries sort of preserves the art of reading, and at some point this young monk discovers a diagram of a circuit And that kicks off the Renaissance, a new Renaissance. So he's basically writing in novel form exactly what Dreyer is calling for, mm-hmm. albeit 30 or 40 years before Dreyer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's those are the places I would go. Much more historical and literary rather than contemporary and cultural, but again, also much darker than your suggestions. Mm-hmm. None of these are sunshiny books or easy reads, but I tend to think that this project is doomed anyway. And we'll put links to some of Dreyer's stuff up also. Mm-hmm.
And then of course there's that Little Way of Ruthie Lemming.
Yes, good call.
Dreyer's particular attempt to live this out by moving back from the shiny lights of DC or New York or Philly or wherever I think he was working most recently.
Yeah, and
moving back to good old St. Francisville.
And there are also obviously writers that have been calling for this sort of thing for a while. So Wendell Berry would be a good example. I don't know if you have read something by Wendell Berry, you've probably read enough by Wendell Berry because they tend to all be kind of the same. But he has something good to say. He just says it over and over and over. So he's sort of a writer that's been doing a lot of that. My dissertation director, Klaus Wren, has been saying stuff like this for a long time now. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's probably what I've got.
Great. Well, thanks for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We are proud to be members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison there is Kristen Filippik. For more information about our own or any of their other shows, please visit us at christianhumanist.org. We'd appreciate it if you would review us on iTunes. That's the best way to help people find our show. We'd also like it if you liked us on Facebook, where you can find us at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can leave us messages there on the Facebook page or contact us directly at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And on behalf of Coyle and myself, let me remind you all to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.